Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome again to another episode of State of Our Nation. Now, unless you were living under a rock in recent weeks, you would have no doubt have witnessed the ongoing fiasco with regards to the leadership struggle within the National Union of Public Workers. That's the largest public sector union in Barbados. Certainly, the state of turmoil within the public sector union is cause for great alarm, as we are speaking of a labor movement that has been the vanguard of public sector workers' rights for many decades. This development comes at a time when there is overwhelming public sentiment that the trade union movement has lost its way and has become too politicized. All this is happening when COVID-19 pandemic has not only exposed the vulnerabilities of labor, but is also reshaping the world of work going forward. As we sit awestruck watching the debacle within the NUPW unfold, and it appears to be heading to court, one can't help but ponder about the situational awareness of unions within this climate. What is the labor charter within the context of COVID-19 and after? This is a key consideration when one considers that all of capital appears to be reading from the same script, one which may not necessarily have a starring role for labor at this point. We are certainly entering uncharted territory, and the critical guiding role of labor advocacy appears to be missing in action at this crucial juncture. Here with me to try to make sense of this state of affairs is Senior Lecturer in Political Science at the University of the West Indies Cable Campus, Dr. Tennyson Joseph, who is also an avid and insightful social commentator. Welcome, Dr. Joseph, and hope that we can try to unravel what's happening here within our trade union movement.
I'm happy to be here, Colton.
Now, first of all, let me give you a chance to weigh in on my preamble. What are your thoughts on what I said? Did I hit the nail on the head as it relates to the state of affairs with the unions in Barbados?
Well, more or less, yes. I think your preamble is right on target. But the only in terms of what you were describing as a broad existential moment in which the labor unions find themselves, or the labor movement as a whole find itself, as well as the broader question of how do you adjust and reform and then make yourself relevant in relation to the dominant issues of the day, and that was largely COVID. And COVID is indeed a kind of era-splitting moment in which there's going to be a pre- and a post-COVID moment. In other words, the world will not be the same. And it is very rare in the life of any living human being, least of all a generation, where you have such ego shifting moments, right? So, always very often in those ego shifting moments, all institutions come under crisis. That is precisely why they are ego shifting moments. So, all of the dominant institutions that used to work and function in a previous moment find themselves in crisis. So, you're quite right in the way you describe the moment. The only thing I'd wish to add to what you were hinting at was that we should not allow a particular moment, a particular episodic incident, as of what is happening in the National Union of Public Workers in Barbados. We shouldn't use those, which I call a very particular moment, a very episodic moment, to allow us to reach broad conclusions about what it might mean for the labor movement as a whole. So perhaps in our discussion today, I would want to deal with both issues, deal with that reality of what might be of greater interest to a Barbadian audience in relation to what's happening to the NUPW. But at the same time, we should never mistake the particular for the universal. We should never mistake the wood for the trees. At all times, let us focus on what is the broader thing. So in relation to that, I would say to you, I don't think the labor movement is in an existential crisis globally, and I'll explain why. But I do think that the issues ongoing in the NUPW are cause for worry, and I will explain why I think so too.
I actually wanted to, now that you mentioned that, that actually brings me to one of my first questions. I mean, we would deal a bit with what's happening within the localized context of the NUPW, and then we go broader out for the union movement on a whole, because there is a lot to unpack there as well. But do you think that the NUPW power struggle is symptomatic of a larger issue?
I would say yes, and that the larger issue is what you describe, and I should have said so in the beginning. You were very correct in what you isolated as the partisan nature of the particular expression of the union movement in Barbados and perhaps many other Caribbean countries. The broad problem I think both of our countries face in this, let's call it 50 to 60 years post-independence period, is that our societies have become politically polarized along silly partisan lines. And I say silly partisan lines to make a distinction. There is nothing wrong with a politicized union in the sense of a union as a political organization defending a working class politically in relation to both international and local circumstances. In fact, every unionist is supposed to be a politician with a specific mandate that is to defend the working class. What has happened to us is that, and it would take a little bit going into history, is that we have become, I certainly think since the 1980s and so on, the discourses in our Caribbean countries have become so silly partisan. In other words, why is it the 1980s? Because prior to that, you had some ideological issues that were dominant. You had broader ideological issues. And when I say broad, you could tap into global movements. There were global movements of which our local parties were part. So whatever you saw happening on the ground, you couldn't say it's a narrow partisan question. But since then, our radio stations, not in Barbados, but in other countries, our radio stations, our television stations, our radio broadcasts, our political commentators, our trade unionists, our churches, and so on, when they speak on very narrow partisan questions, which in the large swathe of human history make no sense. And that is precisely what I think is happening or has happened to the union movement in Barbados. And so let me just explain what I mean by partisan. So there was a history of what we call, and you know that, Colville, called political unionism in our Caribbean. And there was nothing wrong with political unionism. Let me explain why. Coming out of our trade union movement and our national movements, our independence movement were likely coterminous. So roughly since the end of the Second World War, post 1945, you had the Moyne Commission, which gave birth to both, which not gave birth to, but which allowed for the formal recognition of both political parties and trade unions. So the two were born at the same time. So at the time, a lot of the first swathe of Caribbean political leaders, when I call them Caribbean, I mean the genuine post-colonial Caribbean leaders, were trade unionists. And we don't have to name them. We all know who they are. Every Caribbean island, the first chief ministers were, in fact, trade unionists. What happened at the time was when we began to have what is called the committee system, the early semi-autonomous ministerial system, the British colonial authorities were very concerned that you had trade unionists sitting in the ministerial councils and behaving like trade unionists. So they were supposed to be ministers of the crown, but their loyalties were to the working class. So you would have, from my research in St. Lucia, for example, George Charles would sit as Minister of Trade and Industry, Minister of Labour and Social Development in the cabinet or the quasi-cabinet. And as soon as he left the quasi-cabinet, run down to the valleys and tell the workers exactly what was discussed. So the British government had a problem with political unionism. From a developmental point of view, there was nothing wrong with political unionism because you had trade unionists who were sitting, we had what you call social democratic politics taking place, where you had social democrats, labor men, to be quite blunt, sitting in the cabinet and running the countries in the post-independence period as labor men. So all the things which the colonial office could not do, like tax holidays with pay and workers' rights and all of this, the things we now take for granted, these were championed by our first political, let's call them political unionists. When did political unionism enter crisis? Political unionism enter crisis, and the case of Barbados is a good example of it. It happened precisely when our states, our governments, were not being controlled from outside, when you had what I call the neoliberal era coming in. And the classic case of this was under Sandiford in the 1990s period, when you had the trade unionists like Sir
Roy Troutman,
Evelyn Greaves, and other trade unionists, Bobby Morris, these three, who were then forced to then realize for the first time in the history of political unionism, that political unionism had entered what we call a contradiction. The contradiction was that they were sitting as members of social democratic parties, in this case, the DLP, but the DLP was now being forced due to external reasons to undertake anti-union politics. And that is that's why I keep telling you, let's not turn the particular into a general. So the particular episodes that led to the collapse of Sandiford and the crisis of the 1990s are rooted in this global process taking place. Since that global process has played out itself, I can certainly say that political unionism in its traditional 1940s sense had been defeated. That's the best word I would use. And that's why I turn to the final phase, the phase we are in now, which is what that's why I'm making a distinction between political unionism and the politicization of the trade union movement. So right now, since we're talking from largely a Barbadian context, I can give the example of what we saw in the two let's call them Thompson Stewart terms and the current term of Mayor Motley. That is where the contradiction in not political unionism, but the politicization of the trade union movement is now manifesting itself. So what did we see? We saw a set of trade unionists, very experienced people, Bobby Morris included and others, and a younger generation of them, who were sitting who had control of the NUPW and other trade unions and other civic movements, who were acting as if they were defending Stewart administration.
Administration, right.
Right. And that's what they were about. So in other words, it was a period of fundamental economic crisis, but the instinct was to serve as DLP trade unionists. And what happened? The opposite occurred. The people who defeated them were largely BLP trade unionists. And so Akani and the young man who was the treasurer, again, Mr. Beckles.
Asokeri Beckles, right.
Asokeri and them. I'm not calling them names. Asokeri ran as a possible candidate.
Yes, he did.
In a runoff. So these were
that's against
these
were, Humphrey.
Right, very good. And then the people who were critiquing them were basically calling them politicized. So the politicized people on one side are calling the other politicized ones on the other side partisan, which takes us to the present. So what we say should be done is for an era of non-partisan trade unionists to emerge. And there's a whole history of why they become partisan, the attractions of office, the support they get, and so forth. So that's why Colvin, I don't like to use the word crisis, because to me, a crisis only occurs, that's my humble definition. A crisis only exists when a phenomenon emerges for which there is no existing response. So if it's become a constitutional crisis, it means that you're facing with a situation in the country in which the existing constitution has no response to. As long as there is something in the constitution that responds to it, then there is no constitutional crisis. So what I just described doesn't sound like a crisis to me. It calls for a certain type of political response. And very often what I know from history is that those moments present their own solutions. Marx used to say, mankind sets himself only such tasks as he's able to solve. In other words, something is only defined as a problem when the solution for it exists in embryonic form. So if salt has never been invented or discovered, when you taste your breadfruit, you will not say that the breadfruit needs some salt. It is only because there is something called salt that already exists that will allow you to say that the breadfruit needs some salt. So everything you described to me in your preamble suggests that the solution exists in embryonic form, but we just have to wait for history to play it out and so forth. So that is my own interpretation of what is taking place. And of course, it is silly. Now, let me tell you why I'm using the word silly. It has to do with what Lenin would have called a kind of egocentric petty bourgeois careerism, in which the people who are involved in the union are basically careerists fighting for position, which is why Akani, I think, made a fundamental error in going for the general secretaryship and so forth. There are clear lines in terms of functions and roles and who does what and what a general secretary is and what a president is and so forth. These things should be clear. So there's a kind of political ambition that has taken over. Now, these are not crises in the way that I think about it. These are just personality errors. The same way you might have a silly personality error in a Caribbean government or among a Caribbean leader. That doesn't mean that there's a crisis. It just means that a particular personality and a particular set of events that are very particular are taking place, which are cause for concern. But these things are not irresolvable. These things are not things that, in a matter of weeks or matter of months, can resolve themselves. And even the going to the court that you refer to there, that is part of a kind of technical solution to a problem. But sometimes you need more than a technical solution. You need sometimes as well, the deeper things are always political solutions. The more organic ones are more long-term and so forth. So that is how I treat what is going on there with the internal things that are going on in the NUPW.
Want to sell your property or vehicle fast? You can double your chances with Nation Classifieds. Book one-worded advertisements for 1 week or 14 days and double it for free. Both packages include one free photo and free promotion on our websites for 30 days. Nation Classifieds. Double your chances with double the audience and double the value in print, online, and on social media. Call 430-5522 and double the value with Nation Classifieds.
From what you're saying, this would give rise to an evolution in terms of new leadership that can, that is nonpartisan. That is the area that we need to operate in this current climate. However, I would put forward that even, and again, I know you don't want to belabor the NUPW too much on their issues, but one may argue that those that are even vying for the top post at this point are also themselves politically aligned.
But you treat it as if the only two alphabets are A and B. You see that is the error in terms of the. So you're looking at those who are vying versus those who are there. But both of them can be negated. The thesis and the synthesis shall both be negated, and the new synthesis will emerge. So it's not just A and B or black and white. There's a whole set of there's sort of nuances that can take place. And remember too. And you're quite right in terms of what you say in the near present. But remember, our discussion is not about the near present. So while some people are very off, all the pollsters, for example, are trapped in the near present. People who I call narrow empiricists are always trapped in the near present. But the near present for somebody who has a deeper philosophical outlook is just the near present. So you can see 500 years, or I know you don't. Most people don't like to see so far because they only have 70 years to live. But let's say at least we can see 20 years. And we can see 30 years, but that doesn't negate the fact that the long vision is also correct. So those people who you say are vying are both. That's why I described both parties for you. I described both when we started. They're both the same. They both caught in the same historical moment of a period in which our trade unions have become partisan institutions. And we're not just talking about Barbados. We're talking about every Caribbean country. But that doesn't mean that the moment is a permanent moment. It's very, very temporary when you think of the whole stretch and movement of human history and where the Caribbean has to go and so forth. So I am not perturbed by it. In fact, I am happy that those moments, in fact, very often when you have the kind of worldview that I have, I don't have to define it, you are very happy when you see those moments of contradiction and those moments of tension. Okay, it is those moments of contradiction and those moments of tension that point to you as to what the future will look like. In the same way the geologists study volcanic eruptions. Volcanic eruptions don't occur very often, but when they do occur, every geologist worth his salt is running to see what does the volcanic eruption mean for all volcanoes everywhere. In the same way we use moments of tension. So again, I'm not going to define my method for you because that just defining might distract some people, but it is a very valid method of historical analysis, and you don't get it very often on your television and on your radio.
Okay, all right. But if I may challenge a bit your notion that the union movement is not in crisis. It's often said the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and the and what we are seeing manifested currently. Now we are talking at a time, and you have to bear in mind that there has been a whittling down in recent years of union membership, according to the latest count. That it was during that same situation that they had at Lloyd Erskine Sandiford, the petition.
94.
Right.
Okay.
You the count was 6,500 members.
Okay.
Down from, you're talking about 4,000 reduction in the last 4 years. You're also talking about, the BW has been tight-lipped on their numbers.
On numbers.
Mm-hmm. On their numbers. But one can't imagine in this climate, especially when we saw all those wildcat strikes at the time with the hotel sectors and so on, that they are actually increasing membership at this time. How could you say that the union is, I understand what you're saying in terms of the evolution, but the fact that by the time that evolution comes, you mightn't have membership to talk about.
Okay. Let me answer you in two ways or three. One of them was, okay, so if you're looking at numbers, so obviously, when there was increasing employment, and there is increasing unemployment now, sorry, in relation to COVID and so forth, numbers will go down if you look at what's on the books and who's paying dues and so forth. If I'm not working, then I can't be a member of a trade union in a sense. But even then, even in that, and that's my first answer to you, that's where we began to see elements where they were not being creative enough. So, for example, I remember engaging in a newspaper article when the whole thing was taking place with the, when Frendel was in office and the unions were defending and Akani and them were trying to get in at the time. And one of the guys who was a key, well, let's be quite frank, one of the key DLP unionists at the time, he had said, but what can we do with the unemployed? And there was, let's be very precise. Remember when Frendel had made this comment about temporary workers, and they were talking about what they would do in relation to temporary workers no longer being generally part of the civil service and so forth.
I said this is
a moment when a trade union has to be creative, because if there are layoffs and temporary workers and people who were partly associated with the union no longer associated, then you have to then use creative, in other words, broaden your definition of who a worker is, or broaden your mission statement, or broaden your mandate. So the guy from the DIP unit responded and said, so why should we be involved in people who are temporary workers? And I said, try one word, for example, solidarity. So that word solidarity is an old trade union word. They sing it in their labor song, Solidarity Forever. And you in the year 2000 and something couldn't understand how you can apply a notion of solidarity to people who are, let's call them quasi workers, because they are workers, because they, even if you put a label temporary on them, they are workers. So that's why I'm saying to you, Colville, there's no crisis. So in other words, if you're trapped in a kind of narrow, strict sense of who a worker is, and the worker is in the union paying his dues, then you already find yourself in big trouble. So that unemployed tomorrow is a worker. That unemployed today is a worker tomorrow, and so forth. So that's the first answer I will give you. So the numbers thing doesn't really worry me in relation to a labor movement. So who is a laborer? Who is a worker? So some of the bourgeois criticized, oh, you know, you have middle class people, and these middle class people are no longer, all kind of what I would call technical claims about who is a worker. Right? But if you remain trapped in those technical definitions, you're in trouble. But if you understand the movement, and the movement goes way back, you know. The movement doesn't begin in 1945. The movement is a whole historical movement, and you can go back centuries into it. And therefore, what is happening in 2021 can't be divorced from an evolution of a movement in up to the present. That's the first thing I would say in relation to what I mean by the union not responding creatively. So I don't relate a drop in numbers to a crisis. If the economy gets back up again, you'd have more workers in the system. So even what you described there as a loss of membership for the NUPW, we're hearing things about unity, worker unity. So therefore, the numbers thing is not an adequate enough criteria to use to determine whether a union is in crisis or not. The second thing I would say to you has to do with, and precisely what you said about COVID. So I have been observing COVID, and we're saying, and you and I are both, I'm a worker too, Colvin. So I am teaching from home, and my electricity is being used. My Wi-Fi is being used. What is labor time now? What is labor time? In the old strict factory system, we had a clock we used to punch. What you call it, the time clock.
Right.
I work from 8 to 4. That is why you have something called Labor Day. A lot of trade unions don't even know that. Why you have something called Labor Day? Labor Day was meant to celebrate the fact that you won the 8-hour day as what is called a working day. That's why you have something called overtime and double time. You can only have overtime and double time. We don't have labor time. We don't have 8 to 4. My electricity is being used. Remember in the old days when our so-called private sector institutions would get angry with you if you stay home? All of those costs have now turned to the working class. So my water, when I'm home, I'm using it. My electricity, my Wi-Fi bill, my lunch hour, I have no lunch hour. I get emails at 3 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the morning. And so you're telling me, as a labor movement, we can't have a new set of demands to make on an employer class in relation to that. So these are not obsolete. These are not useless things. These are not. And how do you resolve it? Through solidarity.
That's actually one of the areas I want you to get to really zero in on for me, in terms of how does the union define its role now within this context? Because as you said, the world of labor has been reshaped. you rightly said, working from home, how do you quantify that in terms of your resources that you use? You also have the issue of other struggles of vaccination and mm-hmm. stuff that we are hearing deafening silence from the trade union movement at this current juncture. Do you see the union really evolving and stepping up to the plate? And because I see no semblance of that of that trajectory, that they are actually really engulfing these, encompassing these issues that really every blind person could see coming down the road.
Well, okay, because you see, remember, institutions are fit for purpose. That's why I keep telling you. We just got two things there, an institution and the way it defines its mandate, how it is to operate, and a new historical moment that has shown everything asunder, including the institution of the union itself, including the employer class themselves too. And it is in these moments that, so in other words, I'm really saying to you that you perhaps expected it to emerge too fast because it's kind of an organic thing. You're not wrong, because demanding it and expecting it is a good thing. Demanding it and expecting it is the beginning of its arrival. These things have to be, so in other words, perhaps the question might be even something like, who is a trade union leader? That type of individual will be transformed to even the way we measure labor time, but at least the basic core remains the same. What is the role of a union? The role of a union is always what it has always been, to be a defensive organization, aware that we are living in a capitalist environment in which the employer only makes his profit from the extraction of surplus value from the working class. The role of the trade unions historically have always been to try to get the labor to retain as big a share of his surplus value as possible in relation to the employer who's trying to get as much of a bigger share from the labor's own labor value as he can. That's the historical struggle. That's why I tell you the movement has not changed. What has COVID done? COVID has added new dimensions to that same old historical struggle. And what a union is supposed to do is to understand what the historical struggle has always been and how it defines its demand. So even things like, we talk about COVID now, Colvin, but even things like industrial tribunals, when those things were coming about, these are processes that are taking place to make it more difficult. So why am I talking about industrial tribunals? Because the labor movement was based on collective bargaining and solidarity. When you start introducing industrial tribunals, you now reduce it to an individual struggle. A worker who has a particular grievance goes to his lawyer, and the lawyer goes. So now, in other words, so you are now removing another element of the historical way in which a union used to operate. So these are historical things that if you are a progressive person, you keep your eye on those things and you're always critiquing it and you're always intervening at the same time. So what you describe as the comatose nature of our trade unions is the inability to do those things. So in other words, that remember a trade union leader is an intellectual leader as well too, you know. So if you go back, you know what was unique about Barbados? Do you know that both Grantley Adams and I forgot his name now, Hugh Springer, these were Oxford graduates, you know. Oxford graduates who became trade union leaders. You know, I'm not knocking non-Oxford graduates, but I'm just trying to tell you what I mean related to the intellectual leadership of this
Frank Walker.
Frank Walker. He used to write weekly in the paper and talking about the Soviet Union and big issues to do with global events and so forth. That's why I was shocked when the DLP unionists asked me, what is his role in relation to the unemployed or the part-time worker? I found that very strange coming from a trade union leader. You think Frank Walker would ever ask that question? What is my role in relation to the Cold War between the USA and Russia? He had a role to play, which is to write in the paper to let the working class know what are the implications of those things for them. Okay, Winter Crawford used to write in the paper too. So in other words, these are not small matters that allow that you can extract from those things and say, that's not my role as a trade unionist. The trade unionist is an intellectual leader, but trade unionism itself, in terms of broader movement and social change, is as an institution is also hamstrung. That is divorced from what you're describing in relation to the particular union. So if you go back to the debate between Lenin and the trade unionists, Lenin used to argue that what he called them. He said a trade unionist is always conservative narrow economism. And what he was trying to do was to transform the trade unionist into a political person. In other words, so don't just talk bread and butter issues, because the bread and butter issues are what he would call narrow economism. What you do now is to transform the economic struggle into a political struggle. But that's a whole different debate altogether. But the point is, all of the unionists are narrow, petit bourgeois trade union types. And a lot of the limitations that you are seeing arise from that. That doesn't mean in itself that trade unionists or trade unionism is irrelevant. We just point into the broad limitations and so forth. Knowing full well that there are other attendant actions and activities that will take place that are independent of the trade union and so forth.
Okay. Dr. Joseph, well, we are running low on time at this moment. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to wrap up anything that you wanted to add to the conversation that we are having this morning.
Well, what I want to say is that events will play themselves out. I'm very concerned about what COVID-19 means for all of us, but I do think in there you have an opportunity in relation to what our trade unions can do. You see, things like even something like a broad conference. So in other words, our trade unions can organize a broad conference of workers examining the implications of COVID-19 for the future of industrial relations. I'm not a trade unionist, but I'm just showing out to you the kind of thing that they should be doing. So, you know, this little petty squabble we hang about, all trade unions, that could be a massive Caribbean conference and bring everybody together and discuss those things and come out with a program and come out with a set of responses. Even things like contracts. A whole set of contracts. I heard our friend from the BUT talking about that. Something like what's a contract? So your contract would speak about hours of work and place of employment. All of those things are written in contracts. And then hours of work and place of employment. All of those things have been thrown out in relation to what COVID has done. And so he was making the point that we need to really look at all of these contracts all over again. So I am saying to you, Colville, that we are in an epoch shifting period, and in epoch shifting moments, you're going to see what Trotsky used to call it. He said you would see all kinds of strange things. You know, like carnival. You know, when you go to carnival, you see all kinds of strange things, which is why the police are always out there with their guns and things. So when you have those rare moments, you see all kinds of strange things you thought you would have never ever seen. Even Trump's election. He's a man of all kinds of strange things. Like when we were 15 and 25, if somebody had told us that kind of character would emerge to become, we would say no.
Impossible.
We'd say impossible. When we were 15 and 25, if we were told that, you know, no planes would land in Barbados for a period of 6 months and the tourism industry would come, we would say, you're talking nonsense, you're a dreamer. Call a madhouse for him and so forth. Okay? So in these moments, don't be surprised if also trade unions and also the governments, the leadership, caught in the tailspin. But what I can assure you, out of the contradiction, and sometimes too, we have to brace a period of suffering too, because very often those moments come with harsh historical things happening, including war, including civil war, including all kinds of things. I'm not trying to be dismal. I'm just saying that these are the things that happen in those moments of crisis. But after that, it's like almost like what the Christians always tell you, Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again, 1,000 years of peace. After that, then you have a long period of settlement where the thing resolves itself into a new kind of synthesis until new contradictions begin to emerge again. But we are actually living through a moment of harsh contradiction, and I know in the long run we'll come out on the other side.
Dr. Joseph, insightful as always, and again, I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak to not just enlighten me, but also our listeners this morning. There you have it, folks, from one of the top social commentators in Barbados and political scientist, Dr. Tennyson Joseph. And I do want to take the opportunity to thank everyone for joining me this morning, and do have a productive day out there. Thanks again.